Okay, so we're starting chapter 6 today. Okay, so let me I'll read it. Read a couple of the verses to begin. How's the sound? Is it all right?
Yeah, you sound great.
Okay. All right. Okay, so we start 6:1. So there is evil, which I have seen under the sun, and it is predominant upon mankind. I mean, it's found quite often. And now he describes what that is. A man which God gives him wealth and possessions and honor, and he does not lack to his soul anything he desires. And God does not allow him the ability to rule over any of it, to eat from it, to consume it, for a stranger will consume it. This is a futility and a sickness, an evil sickness. Verse 3, if a man will have 100 sons, and he'll live many years, and then his years will increase, and his soul is not satisfied from all the good, also burial he does not receive. I say that better off from him is a stillborn, because, and that goes into verse 4, because a stillborn, in futility does he come, and in darkness does he go, and in darkness is his name covered. Also the sun he has not seen, and he does not know any pleasantries. This to this, lazer mizer, which would appear to mean one person compared to the other, the stillborn compared to the person who lived.
That's all the Hebrew says, is this to this?
Yeah. What does yours have?
My translation says this one had more gratification than that one.
That's actually wrong. It means this one had no more gratification than that one. He says, also the sun, but he did not see, and he did not know any more pleasantries, this one more than this one. Meaning the ones that did not have, the first person in verse 2 who had all the wealth and wasn't satisfied, or the person in verse 3 who had all the children and long life and wasn't satisfied. You see that verse 3, it says that he wasn't satisfied from all the good. Evidently, he's positing that is a good, an absolute good. Having the children was definitely a good, but he didn't derive any benefit from that. And nor did the first person. And Rashi explains that, what does it mean that God didn't allow him? God doesn't hold back a person from using his free will. So Rashi explains it well. He says, what, the person who had all the wealth and his soul was not lacking anything he desired. So Rashi says that, what does it mean that God did not allow him to consume from it? Meaning to say that he should be happy with his portion, to find a settling in his soul with his wealth. Why didn't he find it? Because he desired to oppress and to increase more property. As it says in the book Habakkuk, he quotes here chapter 2 verse 5, he dies and he's not satisfied. And the rabbis also say another thing, they say that a person dies and he doesn't have half the his satisfaction in his hands. And we think we mentioned it once, because the person has $100, he wants $200. He's got $200, he wants $400. meaning whatever a person has, it's not even good enough. It's not. It doesn't even fill him half of what he really wants. Because wherever he's at, he wants more. If he has that sickness of the soul that he's referring to here. That's what he says at the very end of verse 5. This is a sickness of the soul.
And so I just want to clarify. So the way we're interpreting it at the end of verse 5, it's saying this one who was never born and never partook of all this is better off than the ones that are talked about earlier in the verses.
Right. And the reason why he says that is he explains also because he... let's see where, who says that. Okay, Ibn Ezra says, the son also he did not see. This is referring, of course, to the stillborn. Ibn Ezra then explains his commentary. He says, this is now referring back to the stillborn. The Omar, and he speaks, and he says, behold, the stillborn did not see the light of the sun, the light of the world, and he did not know anything. So there was more, he had more ease to him because he did not toil in the matters of the world. But this one who came to the world, and he had riches, and he saw the light of the world, but he knew he would not have any rest. But he would be laboring without any reward and without any time for pleasure in the two worlds. So he's saying the stillborn is better off? Does that make sense to anybody?
I think it does.
Yeah.
Well, I have a problem with it. I got a problem with it. And that being, how do you talk about an individual that didn't even become a person and refer to him as being better off? There was nothing to talk about. Can I say that... absolute emptiness is better off than a life of toil and sweat. I mean, what do you mean better? There's no recipient. If you're going to say that something had a better situation, that means it partook somewhat of the quality of life in order to say this life is better than that life. But you can't say an orange is better than a square. You're not talking about the same currency. So if you talk about a better life, a better existence, both have to partake of existence. But it does not make sense to say that a number is better than a color. You're not talking about the same... you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
That's my problem.
So, well, if we look at what a stillborn is, so a stillborn presumably at some point in the gestation process had life, but maybe only for maybe even as much as just a few seconds, and then dies. So it never experiences the physical world. And it seems like what he's saying is based on, all his previous discussion that the physical world and all the things in it are basically vanity. So it's never going to completely satisfy the human being. So a human being that lives in that environment is continually frustrated and continually in discomfort. So it seems he's saying the one who never experienced all that is better off than the one who experienced just a lot of discomfort.
But it's not all discomfort, because King Solomon says that the person who had all the 100 sons, his soul did not get satisfied from the good. That means there is an objective good that he should have enjoyed. But he's talking about over here the evil he sees under the sun, and it's quite predominant upon mankind. It doesn't mean everybody in mankind has this. He says it's found quite often. That could mean that it's 20% of the time, 40% of the time. Is that telling you that it's something which everybody experiences, this sickness?
Well, I'm not arguing that there's not a good.
Right.
I'm just assuming that what King Solomon's doing is contrasting it and saying the person that partakes of all the things that people think are the good, but that aren't really, is in a case of this state of constant frustration, and that the person who is a stillborn is better off than that guy. I don't think he's saying he's better off than somebody who actually finds what the good is.
Yeah, but there's a problem. There is. You're going to tell me that the person's entire life there wasn't some benefit that he got every single waking moment? That's a real extreme type of an assessment. Even if the guy is chasing after him, didn't he give some charity in his life? Didn't he do some nice deed for somebody? Didn't he help his parents out for some moment in his life? I mean, to live, you have to have friends, and to have friends, you have to reciprocate kindness in order to keep the friends. So how can he make such a statement that the stillborn that had completely no life is better?
Rabbi, could it be that someone who lives that kind of a life is not fulfilling any part of the purpose of man, and when you're not living your purpose, you miss out on the satisfaction that provides?
So, I mean, what he's talking about, though, are only two areas. He's talking about wealth, and he's talking about the enjoyment of children. But isn't there so much more to life than that?
Well, but are you presuming that the case that King Solomon's raising, that he's covering all of life, because he seems to be isolating some pieces?
Yeah, just two pieces, wealth and children.
Right.
Two pieces of what it is, it's a fraction.
Can I pause and zero in on a piece that might have an impact on our question?
Please, go ahead.
The end of verse 3, or near the end, I mean, the verse says, should a man beget 100 children, live many years, and he will have much throughout the days, but his soul will not be sated from all the good, neither did he have burial. Now, that seems rather odd to me.
Yeah, that's also...
But what...
Go ahead.
And does that potentially play into this?
I think you cut off there. You said it's
odd. Go ahead.
You said it also burial it doesn't have. I lost you from that point. Go ahead.
Yeah, that seems like an odd statement. I mean, that's an additional characteristic of the person, because, I mean, most people do have burial. So he must be getting at something. And maybe that something plays into the answer to our question on the stillborn.
Yeah, the Sforno takes that up, and he says, what does it mean that he doesn't have burial? It means that regarding the wealth, he doesn't have any type of eternal happiness that he can derive from his wealth. And also burial he doesn't have. Why? It means to say he hasn't died yet. And in this manner, he's not of the dead, and he's not of the living. I mean, he's at a point in life where he's just so old and decrepit that he wishes he had death, because he's not able to enjoy, because of his feeble nature, I guess, because of his old age, he's not able to enjoy life. So, but when he says in the verse, also burial he doesn't have, it means like he's sort of like an in-between point, such an old age where he's not deriving anything. Not that he won't be buried, but he's not buried yet, as a way of saying that he's that would be better, maybe.
just want to make sure I understand which question's on the table.
Yeah, the question is, what type of assessment is this? That's the primary question that you'll suggest. The stillborn is somehow better. I mean, it's nothing. It's like absolute nothingness, is you're saying, is better than the fact, all right, so he had money, he wasn't able to touch it, but going to Rashi was only because he had this insatiable desire. But what about... Go ahead.
Does Rashi take the comment about the stillborn, who's better than he, meaning the one that's been previously described, and does he take verses 2 and 3 together, or just that the stillborn is contrasting the guy in verse 3?
Right. Rashi says it's false.
Seems like those are two different cases.
Yeah. He says as follows, that he's better off, the stillborn is better off, meaning stillborn of a woman. Why? Because a stillborn comes into the world with a futile existence. I mean, it doesn't exist at all. And then it leaves, and it does not see any good, and it does not desire it. And it also has no pain. But I want you to, again, I think it's important that we understand the introduction he made to this. And we've said this a couple of times, and I think this is really how this is going to have to be explained, because there's one verse, if you look at verse 8, what's the problem in verse 8? What benefit is there to the wise man from the fool? That statement should throw a real monkey wrench into the assessing value of such a statement. It makes you question 1 minute. That's really a faulty type of an assessment. Anybody would tell you that. You look at the end of 6. If a person would be living for 1,000 years twice, meaning 2,000 years, and he has not seen good, is it not to one place that everybody goes? What is he saying? And then he adds on to that. He says, what benefit is there for the wise man over the fool? Now read verse 1 again. And I think you'll see the answer, which we've given many times before. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is quite, it's predominant amongst the men. You see, he says that phrase again, under the sun. And what did we say about under the sun means throughout the Sefer, throughout this book? We said that it means that if the person's assessment of a correct philosophy is limited to the scope of just the earthly existence, then your answers have to be completely foolish. If I assess the value of a life based on just the earthly part of it, and I completely ignore, dismiss, maybe even deny any existence subsequent to death, so then you're going to come up with foolish conclusions. And this is why you can make the statement that better off is the stillborn than the person who toils and has none of this pleasure for his money and all. Because you're saying, really, the end is the same, game over for both at death. But this one had a lot more pain until he got to the death. But now they're equal in terms of death. The only thing is, this other one, he had a lot more pain until he got there. But you're looking at death as being as the end. So if that's true, so it's better off, you just have death without the pain. That's all. That's an assessment based on just an earthly existence and nothing else. Under the sun. Under the sun means this value is now being espoused by those who only look at human life as something that starts with birth and ends with death. Under the sun, on earth. So then you're going to come up with these type of conclusions. If, however, a person understands reality, so you can't tell me that the stillborn is better off, because there is some good. There is something that the person did in his life, his entire life. It doesn't say the guy sinned. It says that he chased after money, and he was never really satisfied with it. Does that mean that the rest of his life, you're completely dismissing any type of good that he did? And that's why you can also make the statement, this answers verse 8. For why is the wise man any better than the fool? If our conclusion is that they both end up in the same spot, if death is the finality of the human experience completely, then you can make that statement. So if we're clear about what he's saying, and we understand his qualification at the outset, under the sun, it pretty much removes all the problems. And we've seen this a number of times.
I have a philosophical problem with this.
Yes.
So if we take out the world to come and we say, okay, all there is this life, then King Solomon's making the case, if I'm understanding it right, that so what's the difference between the rich guy and the poor guy? What's the difference between the wise guy and the fool? They all end up dead at the end.
Right.
But in reality, people do care, and it does make a difference to them, and they work very hard to try to have a roof over their head and food on their table. And they all could look at each other and say, why should I bother working hard? Because, it doesn't matter if I go hungry because we're all going to die anyway. But people don't operate that way. And so I guess I want to argue against his point. I agree that there's, the world to come and something else there, but setting that aside, we do see that people do work, and not just crazy strivings for more and more wealth way after they've gotten everything they rationally need, but people work hard in order to be able to provide just the things that they need.
But is he talking about those people, or is he talking about these two cases of the person who's never satisfied from all the wealth and desires he's got everything? Really, it should be a good. He doesn't satisfy himself. And the person who has all these children.
Well, I guess that's the question. There's something, it seems like there's something more unique about the cases that he's setting up here.
Right.
Like in verse 2, he talks about, if man gives, whom God gives riches and honor, and his soul lacks nothing of all he desires. Now, it's interesting he said his soul, because apparently the guy is very satisfied. But then it says God gives him no power to eat of it, but a strange man eats it. This is vanity and a grievous sickness.
Yes,
but it seems like there's something odd there.
Yeah, there that also struck me. It wasn't me. What's the bothersome point? Rashi, I believe, is one that says that... Let's see what it says. That the strange person consumes it. I'm not sure which one said it, but it means after he died, somebody else consumed it. Meaning to say that a person is bothered by the fact that he has all the money and that somebody else is going to enjoy all my wealth. Which is a foolish statement, because you shouldn't have concerns about when you're not around experiencing the other person consuming your wealth. You're not there anymore. Let me see who said that.
I mean, the truth is also that, you know, when I was going through it, I wasn't sure which way to go, because Rashi talks about the fact that he just didn't benefit as being a real, genuine rejection, that he should have benefited. And had he benefited from the wealth, that would have been a good. Because he says, and his soul was not satisfied. This is on verse 2. So he wasn't satisfied from all that good. He wasn't happy with his portion, that his soul would be cooled off, like he wouldn't be hot, and meaning to say, like he's still passionately seeking more. But he should have been, you know, satisfied with what he had in his hands. And he brings a case from Ahav, who was in the prophets, and he says that all these things happened to him. That he had many children, and he had a lot of riches. But he desired that which belonged to others, and he never found any satisfaction in his wealth. And the end, the dogs ate him. So just in terms of the plain reading, there is a truth there that this is a sickness, that a person really has the good. He has everything he needs physically, and he's not satisfied. So that itself is a rational rejection. It makes sense to reject a person that doesn't do that. But when you come in later on and you tell me that the wise person is no better off than the fool, now that's a problem. Right, he says that to one place in 6, and I still want to work on 6. I have a problem with 6. I don't have it clear yet. But you see, he mentions that everyone goes to one place. So clearly now you see that that's an assessment of life where you're dismissing the afterlife. All right? And it appears to me that all these verses are connected. It's one thought. So if that's one thought, that means he's speaking with one sentiment. And so this sentiment has to apply to them all. Right? He says at the beginning, there's this sickness that I see, and it's very predominant. And it is. Because people are just, the satisfaction, their eyes are too big. They always want what somebody else has, and no matter what they have, they can't get the satisfaction. And it's interesting. It's what the other person has. Why isn't it that it's just, you know, a person has X amount of dollars, whatever it is, why don't we say that he desires more? He says, no, that he desires what another person has, according to Rashi. I mean, he's bringing in the competitive aspect. If the person was the only person in the world, and he had $1 billion, and they saw a gold mine, and he desired it, so there's no element of competition there, because there's nobody else alive. But here it's talking about Rashi, you desire what somebody else has. And that's what he says about Ahav, that he always desired what others had.
Yeah. There seems to be some kind of a theme here about not being able to enjoy pleasure.
Okay.
I mean, don't most of these verses have that in common?
Well, that's just the two verses, 2 and 3. Then in 4 he starts to give an explanation. He now stops talking about the two profiles of the two individuals. Now in 4 he explains a theory. Right? And then in 5 he continues with his theory. Now, what happened in 6? So Rashi is very good on 6. He says, even if the person would live 2,000 years, what benefit would it be? Since he does not see any good, and his end is to return to the dust, like all the other poor people.
See, but then we get asked the same question you asked earlier. I mean, if a guy lived 2,000 years, it's hard to imagine he wouldn't experience some good along the way.
Right.
Solomon is really addressing a philosophy. He's not addressing the fact that somebody might experience some good. He's saying there are people who think this way, that that life is so bitter that you could live 2,000 years and what good would that have done you, because you're just going to dust and you experience so much heartache and pain and not the contentment you could have.
Yeah, I agree with that. And perhaps what he's also adding is that the satisfaction of the people, these type of people, is something which they realize is not eternal, and that makes it bitter. Meaning the philosophy is, even if I would live 2,000 years, I wouldn't see any good. Do I not go to the same place as right? The tova will run, and good I would not see. Why? Hello, is it not so, to one place that everybody goes? Maybe he's giving us an insight into where the problem with the satisfaction is coming from. Why these two people are not satisfied? I think maybe, let's take a look at now 7, the next verse. All the labor of man is for what he eats, and also his soul will not be full. Very interesting verse. Right. So Rashi says, if I'm reading him right, he says, all the labor of man, so is all for his mouth. What does that mean? It means only what he's going to consume here. We talked about this a few weeks ago. The person will be satisfied with that. That would be a good thing. But that's really where all the satisfaction is going to go. He's giving a reality statement here. It'll only go to his mouth. I mean, the only satisfaction he gets is what he's actually going to experience. If he doesn't experience the wealth that he has, he doesn't use it. So what good is it? Right? But Rashi says here, so only the satisfaction he gets is what goes to his mouth. That he should benefit and eat in this world and the next. But this does not give him benefit in his life. But if he means that this person doesn't benefit in his life. I mean, this person is looking for the more. Meaning when a person is not satisfied and is looking for something greater than what reality offers, that's where it's going to fall short. So this is really a statement by King Solomon that what causes the problem. So we could pinpoint this, what he's saying here.
Well, this sort of man, right, he doesn't toil at all for the world to come. He doesn't toil for the Sabbath. Everything he does is for the transitory world. He eats, and of course he becomes hungry again, so everything that he toils for is for his mouth. I mean, everything that he consumes, he will need to consume again. And because nothing that he does has any meaning beyond the here and now, he of course always wants more, because that's all there is to gain another thing.
Well, I don't know... Give me 1 second. I hear what you're saying. Just give me 1 second. I got to think about that.
Rabbi?
1 second, just 1 second.
Okay.
I'm just talking out loud here that the one problem is this, you know, these two types of personalities, whether it's money or family, why is there no satisfaction? I think part of it is the wish that it's eternal, and the frustration knowing that it comes to an end. That's what he says in, I believe, verse 6. Even if it was for 2,000 years, the person had.
Right.
Because he's going to now, since there's an end, so I'm thinking maybe this is one element of the dissatisfaction, you know. And 7 also talks about the fact that, on the one hand, reality is that the work that you do should be for what you consume. That would be the perfect type of a system where the person who could live that way, he'd be the happiest and he'd be satisfied with the work of his hands and he ate from it. There would be a 100% meeting of his desire and his satisfaction. So he'd be complete. There would be a serenity in his soul. But he says at the end of 7, but his soul is not satisfied. Meaning the reason why there's a problem here is that the person's aspirations do not allow him the satisfaction of what reality could really offer. He lives with the fantasy lifestyle, that when I have that big, you know, palace, when I have that the more, if I can get more, then he assumes there's going to be a satisfaction. But we know that he'll just keep on desiring more. So, again, I'm just giving some broad strokes here. I can't say 100%, but it is a difficult chapter that we're heading into here. There's a lot he's saying. And it's hard to tell from which point is the critique, which point is he actually just inserting a piece of reality, meaning what King Solomon really is saying. So hopefully we'll get to that. But clearly when he says in 8
What better benefit is there to the wise man over the fool? That's clearly not his position. That's the position of a person who has the wrong philosophy. And how he's assessing the value of life based on just the earthly existence, under the sun. So I think we have to keep that in mind. That these, when he's talking here, many, many times he's talking not as his own opinion, but he's vocalizing the false opinions of society. Like when he says, what benefit is there from a wise man over the fool? So he's vocalizing a false opinion, and we said at the beginning when we started doing Kahelis that he does that in order to awaken in the person the response, yeah, that's what I really feel. It pulls that out from the person and he keeps it buried. He doesn't want to say these things. But many people have these thoughts and they're afraid to say it. And it sounds like I'm going against God, I'm going against the Torah. So he says this, pulls it out. This was also the reason why the rabbis did not, they wanted to, hide away the whole book. Because it sounds like it's actually the king making opinions that are against the whole philosophy of Torah. How can King Solomon say, what better life is there for a wise man than a fool? What do you mean? So because of statements like that, but they said since it concludes that you should follow God and keep his mitzvos, so that's why they said they're going to not store it away and they'll put it, amongst the rest of the works and pass it down through the generations. Okay, somebody had a question.
Yes, Rabbi, it's me, Shrivka. I just wondered, when people are not satisfied, it could also be it's like a very childish thing. When we see that our parents are very, it's coming from childhood. You see our parents are very generous and they give and they give and they give. It's almost like, okay, you give, so give me more, give me more. They're never satisfied. I'm just associating with that. I could be wrong, but it just seems to be, in my mind, that there is possibly an association that way. What do you think, Rabbi?
You mean to say, where does it come from?
Yeah, I'm saying basically that I think that I'm just saying in my humble opinion that maybe it's coming from the childhood wishes, and maybe not wishes so much, but the childhood where maybe some of us were spoiled and it's easier to get what we wanted. We just had to ask. Whereas others would ask and it wasn't possible, and it's heartbreaking because we always ask and it's as if, but not true, but it's as if Hashem doesn't hear us. And, I hear somebody say to that effect, well, I'll wish somebody good luck and they should have good fortune and so on and so forth. And I'll say something like that, may Hashem bless you. Well, their response will be in a cold way. Well, he hasn't blessed me yet. And I have to prove to them, look at all the blessings you have. You're alive. You're able to talk. There are people that can't even verbalize anything that they're feeling. They don't have the ability to speak. They don't have the ability to walk. I mean, we have so much, but we take so much for granted. We take everything. Not we, you and I, but I'm just saying people in general. Yeah, this is the way it is. This is the general way of things. We have it, we get it, and it's the unusual situation where a person can't walk or can't speak. Yeah, but it may be, thank God, unusual in a way that it doesn't happen that often that we see it. But we don't know how often it's happening, and it's happening plenty. We're just not associating with those people. We're in a different world, so to speak, on a different planet, on a different mental outlook. We just don't appreciate what we have. It's very sad. There's a lot to be said about it. So I'm just thinking, in my humble opinion, I'm thinking that it could be something like that. But, I could be wrong.
Okay, maybe true. Again, but in terms of what, what the verse is dealing with here is what we're trying to understand, and we're not, I'm not saying you're wrong. Regarding the dissatisfaction that certain people have, where it comes from. The question, again, is to try to understand what the phenomena is at hand, what King Solomon is describing here. There may be other things, too. You're right. There are definitely other expressions that people have of dissatisfaction and where it may come from. But, whenever you learn the verses, like in Rabbi Chaim, we always say, you have to let the verses speak to you. And, we can bring in other cases, but it's not going to necessarily help us
understand the words here. What we really have to do is look at the words. And, you know, I have a person I learn with, and we talk, and oftentimes he'll do is when he sees something similar in what we're learning to something he learned in the past, he'll bring it up. But I'll have to remind him that that may be true, but is that going to help in terms of, I mean, it could. But the first step, I think, is really to, you know, focus on the phenomena here, whether the person is dissatisfied, and see if King Solomon's giving us any clues in the verses. You know?
That's, of course, that's the first thing. I'm just associating the other thing with it, like, to make the connection. Because I'm thinking, maybe as your friend is, I'm associating with something I know from before to help me clarify it better. It helps me clarify it, that's all. But I am avoiding it.
I don't know if that's a good approach, because that might convolute it, too. Because then you might start projecting onto these verses things that you experienced in other verses. And really, if you want to understand what King Solomon's saying here, or if you want to understand what any verse is saying, what you have to do is not bring in and not project onto this verse any other associations. Because, in terms of deriving, you know, in terms of deriving what his intended point is, it's, you know, this is my understanding. I mean, I do recall also when I was younger, I was in yeshiva, and there was so I remember one point, you know, I remember specifically there was a case where Rabbi Shaper was giving a class, and I had associated to something else, but it was a compliment, because in that case it was showing a similar how would I put it? It was showing a similar way that God operated. So it showed actually, it was an endorsement of what he was saying. But in this case here, I'm just speaking aloud, what's his point of here? Here he's talking about a person who has dissatisfaction. Now, where is the dissatisfaction coming from here? Right? In terms of this person's experience. So let's see if we can derive it from here. And then we'll see if it plugs into what you're saying. Maybe we'll do it in two steps. Let's see if we can first get the phenomena here, and then we'll see if it relates back to, does it come from youth? And, you know, and the response of people, that I think we have to dismiss, though, for now. Like, you mentioned, like, certain people, you'll tell them that so much good, but then they'll have a very harsh response. Well, that's not this.
Because they hurt.
Well, that doesn't have bearing on here. That I would dismiss.
Okay.
That doesn't have bearing on here. In terms of what you said, does it come from youth? That we could look and see. Okay, so nonetheless, let's go back to the verses. Let's go back to the verses then.
Okay.
Were there any other questions, by the way, before we start going further? I don't mean going further into later verses. I mean going into these verses more in depth. But before I go ahead, is there any other questions that we have? Okay. And by the way, Jim, I haven't forgotten your question from a month ago. I'm still working on it, believe it or not, in terms of the question of why we are obligated in Torah or any commands today when we weren't the ones who accepted it. So I've been making some headway, but I'd like to have something conclusive before I present it, all right?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Rabbi, excuse me, in listening to with the Jim, the question you were talking about, the Jim had asked it, about we're not responsible because we weren't there.
Yeah, what about, what's that?
Yeah, well, weren't we, isn't it mentioned that we are responsible because all the souls were there at Sinai when Hashem gave us?
That's not true. The verse, the verse actually says openly. No, my friend Benjamin Kaplan actually was very good, and he said, if you look at the verse, the plain reading of the verse is that God made a treaty with those people there, and the people who are obligated to keep it, meaning to say that the treaty is available. By the way, if people could put the mute on, there's a lot of static coming in, so put on your mute unless you're asking a question. So what Benjamin Kaplan explained is that it says in Deuteronomy that God is making this treaty available. This is talking about the Jews now to enter the land of Israel. It was a second treaty of Torah. And there is where all the curses were brought about, and that if they keep the Torah and so on, they will have good sustenance, and if not, they will have the worst calamities. And God said that this treaty that I'm making is between you that are standing here today and also those that are not here today. So God says openly that there are people that are not here today. And the commentaries on the spot critique the position that everybody's soul was there. Because God says openly, he's making a treaty with those who are here and those that are not here. So clearly, God's saying that the future generations are not in existence yet. The concept that all the souls were there doesn't make sense. And it goes against what God said. Oh, but that's off the topic, though.
Okay.
So now, let's see in terms of the verses here. Difficult few verses here. Sforno says a funny thing on the first verse. He says that it's a very commonly found thing where people have all this money, but they just don't have the ability to enjoy it. And he says one thing, he says, this happens often on the majority with the species of man. It's like, well, who else is it going to happen to? The species of animal? It's just a funny statement. But he was like a very, very wise commentator, Sforno, so it's worth it to ponder that. What does he mean by that? That it occurs on the majority in the species of man, meaning that man really has a disposition to want more and more. He wants more and more.
Well, Rabbi, you don't really see animals, the species having the same kind of fantasies and stuff. They just kind of enjoy, see a wolf like eating something and not being satisfied with it.
Like, right, but
thinking about what he's going to,
It would just seem to be an unnecessary. All he had to do was say, this is something which happens a lot. Of course it's man.
Yeah.
Of course it's man. What do you mean with the species of man?
Right.
It sounds like he's indicating as part of the design that will just travel through time. I mean, it's a very strong part of the human personality, a very powerful part of the human personality. Yeah, Doug.
Hang on just one second.
Okay.
So to piggyback on Josh's point, though, I wonder if he's trying to point a contrast between man and the beast, in that the beasts live, and every other species lives in the moment, and only man lives kind of in the future and in the past.
Right.
Because if a man lived completely in the moment, he would be satisfied with what he had in that moment, just like a cow that's grazing in the field. cows grazing in the field isn't thinking about whether there's going to be grass next summer.
Right.
I'm not sure where to take that. I'm just observing.
No, I agree with that 100%. I think that that might even be what he's talking about in verse 7, where he says, all the labor of man is to his mouth. Meaning that would be the best thing. I think we also talked about it prior, this very point. In 5:17 we said as follows, because it said the verse, "Behold, I've seen that it is good for man to eat and to drink and to see good in all his labor." Now, what is it to eat and to drink, right? But what's the additional thing that he should also see good in all of his labor? That he labors under the sun, the few days of his life. I think this is your point, Doug, that we discussed this, and we said that if man can see the satisfaction in all of his labor, meaning if all the labor I exert, that I consume everything which I exerted, that would be the proper thing. That's living in the moment. That means to say, what I do now, I enjoy now. I work more, and then I enjoy that food. But if I'm not enjoying all my labor, and all my labor is piling up things for the future that I never reach, I never consume, so that's where the dissatisfaction comes in. Because the person's unhappy that he can't really make use of everything he's piled up. And he's going to leave it to somebody else. So that's another thing. That's a secondary problem. Secondary problem is that he's going to leave it to somebody else. The initial problem that happens just in terms of time is that the inability to really, indulge is just too much. A person feels almost compelled. I want to work, I want to make more, but I also want to enjoy what I earned already, and I can't do both at the same time. So maybe that's what he's saying in 5:17. That a person's real, what's really good is going to be if a person eats and drinks, and to, that's one thing, to consume, but to see the good in all of his labor that he works under the sun. I mean, if he can enjoy using everything that he worked for, but if he doesn't enjoy it, and he's only making use of half of it because the other half is just, it's too much, so that can produce that the dissatisfaction. Your point, though, Doug, is slightly different. Your point is that the person can't just enjoy what he's eating right now because he's worrying about tomorrow, the next day. Now, what exactly is the worry? What's the concern that he has? Is the concern that he'll have more? That could be for a person that doesn't have enough. But let's say a person has enough. So maybe a person who has enough is what he's talking about here in 5:17. This is the problem in the human, in the human psyche, that if he can't make use of what he's earned, so that's one type of a pain. Really, if the person's made so much, he could give himself a break. He doesn't have to keep on toiling. But then there's a person that doesn't have enough, so we'd have to see what he says about that. But I'm just, I think that's what we had said that a few weeks back. You see, he says that in 5:18. He says, because all of man is that God gives him wealth and possessions, and he allows him to eat from it. You see, this is just the opposite of the verse we're doing now. Here is where he's saying the positive. Because all of man, meaning his whole purpose, his whole life that could be good, is that, again, that God gives him wealth and possessions, right? As opposed to what we said in this verse is that there's honor. The dissatisfied person is where God gives him wealth and possessions and honor. Now he's looking for the fantasy. You don't need honor. So this verse, in which is 6:2, is direct contrast to a few verses back in 5:18. 5:18 is telling you the good. God gives a person wealth and possessions, and he allows the person to enjoy it and to take his portion and to be glad with his labor. You see that again? Glad with his labor. He worked, and now he's enjoying what he worked for. You see that? That's an important thing. That the person could do, he could apply the labor and make use of it. Because there's a satisfaction now when I can enjoy the products of what I've labored. But let's say I work and I work and I work and I store it away, and I never partake of it. Psychologically, that is going to create a dissatisfaction in the person. Happiness comes, and this is no reason for this. This is like why, this is just a fact. This is where we are designed. You don't have to give a reason for it. Happiness comes when the person works and he enjoys what they work for. That's how we're designed to be happy. That's a natural result of partaking. I work half the day, and the other half of the day I make use of what I just farmed in the field. This is now going to give a person a satisfaction that the toil of his hands is now giving him the warm meal that he has tonight. And to be glad in his portion. This, he says, is a gift of God. And gift of God can mean to say that this is the design of God. That's the gift. That the very design. Let's see if anybody says anything on that. That's 18. Yes, Sforno says that this happens very few times. The one who acquires wealth with his endeavors and his toil, that he merits to benefit from it by himself. But that's how the rabbis and the Talmud lived. They'd have the store open, that they'd be wood choppers or water drawers, you know, very simple type of work, and they had enough for the day, they shut the shop. And that was it. Be involved in learning for the rest of the day. But like you're saying, though, the person who's dissatisfied is where he's living with a fantasy. No, he's not living in the moment. Okay. Actually, let me just see if there's any questions or comments. I know you have the next class, so and then we'll go back into this and review it again next week. But let me see if there's any questions or comments for now.
I think we're okay.
Okay. All right, so we'll pick up next week, and we'll continue with this, all right?
All right, thanks very much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Good week, everybody.
Thank you. Have a good week, everybody.
Good week.